back to the bin. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm Paul Spataro, and I am stateside with my good friend, Mr. David Pescarella, as we are going to travel to the European War Theater.
Reporting for duty. Are we actually going to Europe, or are we staying in the Pacific?
Are we going to Addis Ababa, Mr. Pescarella?
Are we going to Addis Ababa? I wonder what they're wearing. Looks like a burnous.
So we're taking a look. We're going to look at the next issue of Storming Paradise as we slowly work our way through that series.
Hey, we're past the midway point today.
Yeah, today takes us past it. And again, I'll just say, without giving too much, this series has kind of felt like a little inconsistent to me. I would say it's got ups and downs, and there's moments where I think, oh, this is like great. And then there's moments where I'm thinking, I don't need to read this. So it's definitely all over the map.
It definitely has highs and lows.
Yeah. But that's, you know, that's kind of what makes it fun to review, honestly. So as we record this now, this isn't going to be heard for quite a while, so this current event news is not going to be really current when you hear this. But as of 2 days ago, before we recorded this, we got word that Jim Shooter had passed away. And I was kind of saddened by that. I met Jim Shooter twice, once at Eternal Con, where I stopped by his table and I was talking to him for a little while, and struck me as a nice guy. And another time at Best Comics International, he was there with Jeff Vaughn, who, if you've heard enough any of the James Bond episodes on Is It Yours, you know Jeff, and he was promoting one of his series that was coming out, and Jim had contributed to it, and so he was there as well. So that was a kind of a more personal meet up, because I got there like kind of as they were winding down, so that I wasn't fighting a crowd. And because I'm friendly with Jeff, you know, it was definitely more of a conversational thing than a fanboy thing. So I thought that was pretty cool. And I thought Shooter was a very nice guy. So I'm, you know, saddened by his passing.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Very unfortunate.
Absolutely. So that said, maybe we'll do some sort of a spotlight episode on Shooter. And, you know, I mean, I don't know how much you're on top of his career, but he started writing Legion of Superheroes and Adventure Comics when he was 14 years old.
I think I did know that he was a teenager when he started.
Not even a teenager, like kind of a, you know, before the halfway mark, he was 14 years old. I find that amazing. So I think what I'd like to do is maybe take either two of those issues, or take one of those issues and then one, you know, much later in his career, and do a spotlight episode.
Sure, why not?
Why not is exactly what I was saying.
This is your stage.
Oh, wow. It's nice to have a stage.
It's your world, but we're just living in it.
Ever since Scott made the mistake of saying, yeah, do you want to be on Back to the Bins? Then I took the keys to the office, and he's lucky I let him in.
Told him to get his crap out. I mean, yeah, sure. That sounds good.
It's like a typical bad marriage. Yeah, you know, yeah, come on, move in with me. What do you mean I'm out now?
It starts with just a drawer, and next thing you know, you got the whole place.
Yeah, exactly. It's all mine. I should be like wringing my fingers and doing my Mr. Burns imitation.
Or your evil cackle.
I do have an evil cackle. Anyway, so we doing Storming Paradise first, or
yes,
Captain Savage and his Leatherneck Raiders?
Let's go with Storming Paradise first.
right, then the stage is yours. I will I will be muting myself.
Okie doke. Storming Paradise number 4. Cover dated December of 2008. This was on sale November 5th of 2008 for a whopping $2.99. Our writer is Chuck Dixon. Penciler, Jackson Geis. Inca, Eduardo Barreto. Letterist, Patrick Brosseau. Colorist, Carrie Strachan. And editor, Benjamin Abernathy. Now, for this book, since we're more than halfway through, I got the brilliant idea from Scott Gardner on Justice League to do a roll call just to keep track of these people. In this issue, we have Walter, the German scientist. Kurt, another German scientist. Harv, a U.S. Army soldier. Jimmy, the U.S. Army Nisi translator. Father Daniel Monahan, an Irish Roman Catholic priest. Fumiko, the young niece of prominent Japanese doctor Iseya, who was seeking to improve her English. Haruko, mother of Fumiko. General of the Army Douglas MacArthur. Lieutenant General George S. Patton. And there's a surprise guest star in the role of a United States Marine. We open up on December 29th, 1945, the Nagasaki Prefecture Restricted Naval District. German scientists work on a massive plutonium atom bomb. The weapon will fall under the purview of the Navy, as the Army lacks aircraft of sufficient size to even carry the smaller model of the German bomb, the Hermann. The German Walter questions the Japanese admiral's plan as to deployment of the bomb. The admiral's response is that he relays the wishes of his emperor. The Americans will be sufficiently impressed with the weapon that they will entertain a negotiated peace. Upon the departure of the Japanese officers, the Germans discuss that this could be Japan's last chance to obtain a negotiated peace. It is a thin chance on an untested device and an untested theory. Kurt questions whether the bomb should still be called the Hermann. Walter replies, "It still reminds me of Goering. Like our former Reichsmarschall, it is too heavy to get its fat ass off the ground." January 1st, 1946, Ebano Factory District. U.S. Army soldiers, Harv and Jimmy, find themselves with a group of Marines. Harv asks Jimmy if he celebrates New Year's, being that he's of Japanese origin. Jimmy replies, "That's Chinese New Year, you dumb Texan." The lead Marine is on a mission to get a prisoner and return him to the command post. Harv advises they leave this gung-ho crap to the jarheads. As they enter an alley strewn with wreckage, a shot rings out and the lead Marine goes down. And someone calls out, "Schwally is down." Schwally could be a name, but it also means a person who likes to take action and get things done. I looked that up for you. Suddenly, debris begins to rain down on the troops from the rooftop surrounding them. The troops begin firing as grenades from above start to detonate. They find the quote-unquote big dope still breathing, and an order is issued to Harv and Jimmy to get Duke back to the corpsman as the rest prepare to blow the barricade. Elsewhere in the dark, Father Daniel Monahan traverses a field of ruin. He is intercepted by a Japanese patrol. When he tries to explain that he is authorized to be there, he is hit in the back by a soldier's rifle and accused of being a spy. Luckily, one of the soldiers reads Father Daniel's papers and pronounces that he has a pass to travel here. In the pouring rain, Jimmy and Harv complain about having to carry such a big sumbitch back. They arrive at camp with the wounded Marine. The corpsman unwrap the face wound, and one comes out to tell Harv and Jimmy that they're going to get their pictures in the paper. They doubt that, but the corpsman questions, "Don't you ever go to the movies? Ever seen Stagecoach? You just saved the Ringo Kid." John Wayne. January 5th, 1946. The fleet anchor at Nakina. On a table surrounded by maps and documents are photos of the German scientists, Walter and Kurt. One U.S. officer comments, "Two Nazi physicists, we know we're in Germany's atomic bomb program, are now cooling their heels in Nagasaki." Concern grows that the Japanese may be close to a bomb, and their operative in the country has missed his last check-in. The U.S. intelligence needs more from their operative, if he's still alive. They need to know information such as deployment methods. Suddenly, General Quarters sounds. The gunners on the ship take out an inbound Japanese plane. They're a little surprised that it's only one plane, as they usually come in droves. Then a small Japanese vessel, probably about the size of a PT boat, is spotted heading for the warship. But it's too little too late. The suicide ship impacts, and the detonation breaches the hull. January 11th, 1946, Nagasaki Prefecture. Father Daniel arrives at the home of Dr. Isaya. Also present are Walter and Kurt. Haruko is outraged at the priest's treatment. Father Daniel stops on his way to Fumiko to eavesdrop on the Germans' conversations. Walter complains about the weather and how the Japanese are impatient with their progress. Kurt responds, "Progress? Can you call it that? The possibilities here are primitive. The Japanese know nothing of core dynamics." Walter suggests, since time is running out, an alternative use of materials. Kurt is open to any solution, but before Father Daniel can hear more, Fumiko arrives, and the priest is off to regale the child with stories of Ireland. January 12th, 1946. Harv has his picture taken by a photographer who tells him he'll probably be in Life magazine or Collier's, since Harv's the man who saved John Wayne's life. When Harv insists Jimmy be photographed as well, he declines, saying he already has enough pictures of Japanese. The backdrop of this scene is a burial detail, filling a trench with dead Japanese soldiers. Jimmy voices his thoughts to Harv, how if his grandparents hadn't moved to Kansas, it could be him in that trench. Harv replies that if his mom hadn't left Poland, who knows what would have happened to him. As they walk away, Harv comments, he's canceling his subscription to Life magazine. January 22nd, the skies above Kuma-Oti. A squad of Navy Avengers hits a Japanese convoy moving south. General MacArthur is told and responds, "Pray the weather holds." January 24th, 1946. Kaiomachi in the Sendai River Valley. With the rain having grounded the Air Corps, General Patton is at the front of the only division between the Japanese and Ebino. He refuses to give back the gains of 3 weeks of hard fighting, and that is why he has placed himself right in the path of a major Japanese counteroffensive. Suddenly, the general encounters retreating troops who inform him that they are the forward recon and the Japanese infantry is coming. Patton orders the 50 caliber machine gun on the tank to be uncovered and remarks that the little bastards are coming into bayonet range. Banzai echoes throughout the valley as waves and waves of Japanese troops charge. And that is issue 4.
Some pretty interesting stuff overall, I thought. You know what it's got me thinking now, which I really hadn't thought through the first three, that is, in as much as this is a what if story, effectively, you know, an alternate world, an else world, we might lose the war. You know, like, that really hadn't even occurred to me as we as I started reading this, that that might be where this is going, especially since they give a, they keep giving us, in the, at least in the last two issues, that Japan is kind of trying to save face, that, you know, they're trying to work out to get the best surrender possible, which is, I think, setting us up as readers to be overconfident in the likelihood of American or Allied victory in this conflict. So now I'm starting to question, you know, where are we going to go? What's going to be the end game for this particular storyline? How are they going to bring us home? I was a little surprised at the John Wayne aspect. I was glad they brought him back, but I was a little surprised that they brought him back for such a small action moment before he was just somebody to be discussed. I kind of thought he would have a more pivotal role in what was going on, not so much the aftermath of what he did or what happened to him. So, but it's definitely got me curious as to where issues 5 and 6 are going to go.
Yeah.
And obviously,
I don't remember.
I was going to say, you know, but you're not going to tell me, which is,
no, I don't remember where they go. I remember John Wayne getting shot, but.
So you don't know if we win the war or not.
I don't think it's anything as massive as that. I don't recall. I don't recall. I don't believe it's as massive as that, as an alternate history.
I would think that would be an interesting way to go, though. That's, like I said, it's the first time that that occurred to me. The first three issues I read through, and I just assumed, yeah, it's going to end, you know, it's going to be kind of, you know, that we're fated to win, and it's just going to, you know, be done in a different manner, and that's what we're following. But then, you know, they start thinking, well, you know, again, they just keep saying, you know, Japan's trying to work out the best bargain it can. So it would make sense to have the tide turn somehow and, you know, Japan take, you know, victory from the jaws of defeat.
I don't think it's possible, to be honest with you. I mean, for them, I think victory is if they were to win, quote unquote. The win is they're not going to be occupied. You know what I'm saying?
Mm.
But I don't see it possible that they could possibly win.
Well, yeah, you know what? That's an interesting question too. Is, you know, what would constitute a win at this point? And yeah, I mean, obviously they're not going to have world domination,
right?
But you know, if they were able to mount enough of an offensive to make the Allied forces retreat out of Japan and allow them to their own devices, I think that would be a victory at this point.
Right.
You know, it's almost like the Nazis and the Japanese and the Italians. I hate to put the Italians in with that group, but it's almost like, you know, they were looking to dominate and take over other lands. Now victory would just be keeping their own land.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the Italians have been long out of the war by this point. The Germans, yes, they're out of the war. There's no.
So it's just Japan.
You know, after we won, they went through the Japanese archives and they found, like, I guess, studies, you'd call them, where Japan had said, like, way back. As for, like, occupying the United States, they were like, forget it. They got too many people. They got too many guns over there. Japan would never have been able to take the United States.
Well, that's the thing that's, like, simplified if you play a game of Risk, which is not a simple game, but it simplifies the whole, you know, controlling the world theory. Because the more areas you conquer in the game Risk, which I haven't played in many years, but the more areas that you conquer, the thinner you spread your resources, mm-hmm, and the more difficult it is to maintain that control. And I think that is a simplified version of what real life is if you're trying to, you know, take over the world.
Right. Because it's not like you're going to take somebody and, okay, their folks are now just going to get in line and, you know, join your army.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and we've seen it, you know, when we've tried to build governments in parts of the world where, you know, the people are oppressed and they don't live our lifestyle. And we come in and we say, you know, we're going to give them a better lifestyle. We're going to build a government here. And we get totally rejected by the people just the same, because they, you know, they don't want our lifestyle.
Mind your business.
Yeah, that's really what it comes down to sometimes.
And the irony is the occupation of Japan went so well in the real world once, you know, the surrender hit. Was built up. It was westernized. Democracy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it almost feels like we felt so guilty for dropping those bombs.
Oh, I think that's today's way of looking at it. After the war, I don't think people felt as guilty as people today feel.
I don't feel guilty.
I didn't mean you,
but I think there's a pervasive feeling of that you know, oh, we have to help rebuild this land because look what we did to it, and you know, we ended up giving them resources to rebuild themselves, which I don't want to get into the right and wrong of all of that, because I do understand there were innocent people who were, you know, greatly damaged or killed because of the war. So it's not that everybody there was, you know, what the propaganda machine would have everyone believe, but it also, you know, I believe that we spread ourselves a little thinner to try and, you know, help rebuild their world or their lands.
I think it was more, we need them against the communists is what it was, you know, after the war. And, you know, there were a lot of atrocities that people kind of put on the back burner that happened in China. That Japan did to China. But, you know, it was, well, China went communist, so the hell with them. We need Japan on our side.
Well, you see this stuff all the time. You know, I mean, I think it's funny, you know, like if you see the movie Rambo 3, it's dedicated to the brave people of Afghanistan. because then they were opposing Russian domination.
Mm-hmm. The Mujahideen.
Yeah, so when they were opposing Russia, it was like, yeah, we're all for you guys. Until later on, we became very, you know, their enemy. So,
but you know, we used to be fairly good at that, you know, giving people money to do what needs to be done, and we're going to just stay out of your business then. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, there's all sorts of political...
Prop up the front, man, and we're going to keep quiet, yeah.
Yeah, we have nothing to do with this. So, again, I think the artwork in this is very fitting of the story. And I think in this particular issue, I see a variation, which I've seen a little bit before. But you see, like, the daytime scenes have a brightness to them. Even, you know, when John Wayne is getting shot, you know, there's definitely a brightness, but also a darkness of storytelling, not so much in the images, but I think it's got the right balance and feel to it, especially then when, you know, when they bring him to the infirmary and, you know, it's raining and it's dark out, and it just, you know, there's like a foreboding feeling to it. And then, you know, we get to headquarters and it's all bright.
Yep.
You know, it varies well, and I think it does a good job of storytelling.
What do you think the reason is we don't actually see John Wayne's face? Do you think it's, can you copyright or trademark or whatever the hell it is? It's not a trademark, copyright. Like, is his image copyrighted or something?
I don't know about the word copyright, but I do think that his estate probably has the rights to his likeness. And you know, I know when they've used, you know, computer generated images of people who have passed, they do have to get the estate to approve it. You know, you can't just use that on your own.
So, but is it, if you're a if you were just a public figure as opposed to a, so like General MacArthur's likeness, General Patton's likeness or Truman's likeness.
I think that might be fair use because they are public figures in that respect, whereas John Wayne was a public figure, but he was a public figure for portraying characters like he is in this story to some extent. And I do think there might be issues with the estate, and they might have just bypassed that by never showing his face.
Right.
You know, just using his name and having him included in the story, I don't know that you legally have to obtain the estate's permission for that. I know, I'm just thinking, you know, I've read stories by Stephen King where he'll mention, you know, some famous person in passing, and I don't think you have to get the person to approve that to do it.
But if you were going to make a movie and put them in it,
I think then you might. But then I don't even know. I think then it might. I'm just thinking about it. I'm really all over the map here. But I'm just thinking of, there was a movie called I think it was called Heartbreak Hotel, and it was a fantasy story about a teenager who actually kidnapped Elvis because his mother was such a huge Elvis fan. And then he ends up, like, over the course of time, Elvis actually becomes friends with the family, and like it's a lighthearted story.
Stockholm Syndrome.
It was actually very entertaining. I saw it back in the 80s. I haven't seen it since then. And I remember talking to my wife about it after we saw the most recent Elvis movie, saying, we need to rewatch this one because I haven't seen it in 40 years and I remember liking it. I think David Keith played Elvis and did a pretty good job with it. And but I don't think they had to get Elvis's estate to give permission to do that. So probably, again, I'm all over the map. I don't know what it is, but I wonder if it's just a choice to leave his image out of it, that they don't want to, you know, they don't want to overdo it, or they're trying to keep some mystery involved.
Yeah, could be. But it was interesting to see what happened to him, as opposed to the figures he played in the movies.
Well, but they have him, you know, and thank you for looking up that word, but what did, you know, Mr. Gung-Ho or whatever it was.
Swally.
Yeah. So that's saying, you know, just the fact that he has a reputation as being so gung-ho is saying he's trying to live up to his, you know, cinematic persona.
Well, I guess if you think about it, what was it? The Sands of Iwo Jima. That's one of, I think, the 8 movies he dies in. Sergeant Stryker.
I don't like when he dies in movies.
Dies in the Fighting Seabees, too.
Yes. Wake of the Red Witch.
The Shootist.
The Shootist and the Cowboys. And I can't think of off the top of my head what else.
I cannot either.
That used to be a trivia question that in the local pub I hung out in, that we would dig up every once in a while and we'd go through the list. That's why I remember The Wake of the Red Witch, because that was always the toughest one.
I don't think I've ever seen that one.
I saw it. I couldn't tell you anything about it, but that was when I was, you know, back when you'd go to the video store and you'd rent VHS tapes for $1.
Yes.
And I would go through a streak where I'd say, okay, you know, they'd have the store broken up into the classics and all of the stuff, and then they'd have sections. You know, they had a row with all Humphrey Bogart movies, and a row with John Wayne movies, and a row with Alfred Hitchcock movies. And I would just go through different phases. And at one point, I went into a John Wayne phase, and I watched it at that point. But I don't really remember too many of the details.
I do enjoy John Wayne.
As do I. And I... You know, yes, he got hurt here, and yes, he wasn't the big war hero, but I thought he was well portrayed in that, you know, he's gung-ho, he's volunteering for duty even though they didn't want him to.
It's like I could hear him saying, saddle up, as they go off.
You know, I saw recently, you know, if you see, they have these AI things where they'll show an actor and either they'll go forward in time or backwards in time. But they'll say, you know, at 22, he did this. At 28, he did this. 29, he did this. And it was a John Wayne one. And it was interesting, you know, seeing like, you know, it said, you know, in his first movie at whatever he was, 22 years old, his first starring movie at 28 years old, then, you know, won the Academy Award at, I think he was, I think he was in his 50s. It might have been 60 when he was in True Grit.
Yeah. He was quite old. It was right before he died, a couple of years.
Well, he True Grit, I think, was in 69, and he died, I think, in 76. And The Shootist was his last movie, which is a very fitting final showing. We've never covered that on Is It Yours, but I would recommend it to anybody who does like John Wayne movies. John Wayne, Ron Howard, Lauren Bacall, excellent movie.
He's telling us for the last time everything that he believes in.
Yeah, we'll see. You also had Jimmy Stewart.
I'm blanking. Colonel Potter's in it, but I can't think of his real name.
Henry Morgan or Harry Morgan?
Harry Morgan.
Yeah, a lot of good. It was a very, very good movie. A nice final statement.
Did you do Stagecoach?
Nope.
Oh, well, keep me in mind for that.
I will do so.
That is the movie, you know. My mother took a class when she, you know, when you're getting your extra credits to be a teacher. Mm-hmm. It was a film class, and they discussed all these old Westerns. And the Stagecoach was allegedly the first movie where they used what became the trope of the cavalry coming to the rescue at the last minute. Where they're in the stagecoach, and it's a, I think a woman even says, you know, there's no hope for us as the Indians are closing in. And then you hear in the distance the bugle and the cavalry comes over the hill.
I saw that also in a film class, and I don't remember what specifically they, you know, they were pointing to say that this was a class, you know, they had a specific reason to have it earmarked as a classic that was worth watching. And I don't remember what the reasoning was at that point, but I do remember, like most John Wayne movies I've seen, that I enjoyed it.
As a kid, I had a toy rifle and I used to practice to spin it around just like John Wayne did.
What you mean in True Grit?
No, in The Shootist. Oh, when not The Shootist, the Stagecoach.
When you he cracks the guy in the face with it, you mean? Or?
No, he like, you know, like you can spin your revolver on your hand. He spins the whole rifle around, like his arm is extended, and he spins it on the trigger grip. Like he flips it over.
Okay, I didn't even remember that. In True Grit, he flips the rifle to cock it, which was a very cool maneuver.
It's all a lost art. Nobody watches these movies anymore.
I think True Grit is such a good movie. We saw that when I was a kid in Radio City Music Hall, back when they used to show movies there. And I was just riveted to the screen for that. I mean, I must have been 8 years old. And I loved it so much. And then, you know, just the final, towards the end when he's facing off against Robert Duvall, and he's tells him surrender or whatever, and says, that's bull talk for a one-eyed fat man. He says, fill your hand, you son of a bitch, and he rides right at him. It's so cool.
Yeah. Next on the John Wayne podcast.
I love John Wayne movies, but we digress. The last scene in this book with the Japanese yelling banzai and running towards them, I guess it's kind of like a suicide gambit. Like, we're going to lose some of our guys here, but we're going to take out this hill kind of thing.
Yeah. That's a scene right out of a movie. I could tell you what movie that's from. That exact scene is in the movie MacArthur.
Which I've never seen.
Gregory Peck, they're fighting New Guinea. I believe it's New Guinea. And you get a wave of Japanese charging just like that with the banzai.
It's either that or The Walking Dead. Well, that's the feeling. Honestly, that's the feeling it gives me. Just that claustrophobic feeling where there's nowhere to turn. Everywhere you look, there's somebody coming at you. And I think that's an impressive image and a
very, I don't remember
very where this, foreboding feeling.
Right. I don't remember where this is going. And like Patton's right there. Is this going to be George Patton's last stand?
Well, again, it's a what if story, so they can kill off whoever they want. So definitely enjoyed this. But again, it was a little kind of inconsistent in that. Well, this is the first issue. I'm just thinking with what's his name, Jimmy, the Japanese guy, and his partner. They're kind of the first people who I'm kind of feeling like a kinship towards. Like I'm interested in their story as opposed to just the story.
Right.
So you know, it took four issues to get us to that.
It's them and the priest. That's it. They're really the only characters.
Yeah, and even the priest, I'm not really like relating to. I'm just kind of saying, yeah, he's an Irish guy. So, but
and again, they did that bit in the book where all the conversation with the Germans is all in German, and they don't give you a translation. I did that for you, thanks to Google.
Yeah, that's where the Google Translator app is pretty cool.
I'm curious to see where this is going as far as, you know, at least if this was Patton's last stand.
Well, I guess we'll know that next issue.
Kind of ironic, though. This is the way he probably would have preferred to go as opposed to, you know, a car accident, paralyzed in a hospital.
Yeah, absolutely. So I would rather go this way than the car accident, paralyzed in a hospital. So ready to rate it?
Yes. The cover, a GI on a machine gun with "Give Him Hell" in red block letters. To me, you don't get much more reminiscent of a World War II propaganda poster than this. I think it's great. The determination on the soldiers' faces, powerful. And there's something about that image on the machine gun with him blazing away that reminds me, we're going to get into movies again, of the final scene in the movie Wake Island, where it's these Marines on a machine gun as the Japanese are storming the island. There's a dark background, but it's not just a black background. It's clearly the darkness of the jungle. I think it's a powerful cover. And for that reason, I'm giving the cover an A. Sold me on this cover. The interior art, to me, it's detailed. I find it consistent with the other books. Characters we've previously met, they're very identifiable easily. There were certain characteristics, and the two examples I throw out there is the medic. When they bring John Wayne to the hospital, the guy with the cigarette hanging out of his mouth, and the photographer wearing the cap who takes Harv's picture, they reminded me of like those cartoons you'd see from the war era in the newspaper, of like two GIs, kind of like that Ernie Pyle type of look. It's a little different than the rest. I felt it was different from the rest of the art in the book, that was more like period comic art almost. The battle scenes, I felt they were very powerful. The real people, Patton and MacArthur, you know, you just look at the image, you know who they were supposed to be. And the equipment too, I felt is very realistically drawn, particularly the Navy Avenger. So the interior art, I gave a solid B+. On the story, I feel it's ratcheting up the tension. You know, Japan now has the bomb. How will they deliver it? Where will they deliver it? Will it work? Are they going to put it on the ship and try and take out the fleet? They're going to stick it somewhere and then fall back and try and take out our army. The suicide attacks and the defenses. As I said before, a little bit, I wasn't quite in love with what happened to John Wayne. I would have liked to have seen him a little more, you know, as the hero of the piece, but I get it's not you know, a John Wayne movie. It's the, supposedly the real world. I'm curious to find out who the spy is, and is he going to find out about the bomb? Or she, for all I know. So the story, I gave an A. For an overall grade on this one, of an A minus.
Okay. I like the color cover image very much. I don't like the fact that it takes up two-thirds of the cover and that the bottom of it is got a lot of blank space for the UPC box and stuff. So I don't like the layout of the cover. I like the image, though. So I'm kind of saying, do I take points off for the layout, or the, which I think is probably more an editorial decision than it is an artistic one. So I'm not going to take points off for that. So just for the image, it's different because we're not getting stories here that are, or covers that are specifically related to the story that we're getting. It's more just an image to be, I guess, nostalgic or reminiscent of the era that it's supposed to be from. So I'm going to say, you know, solid B plus. It's a very good image, and it kind of brings up some thoughts, you know, just feelings and whatever. The interior art, I think the interior art's very solid. Like I said, I think it's very mood setting for whatever's going on at different points. I, like you said, I think you are able to distinguish certain characters, which is important. I think the storytelling is there that you could follow what's going on fairly easy. So I'm going to say an A minus on the art. I think it's very solid. And the story, you know, got me interested in seeing what happens next. And that's one of the biggest keys to these stories, is just, you know, keep me interested. I you know, like you said, I would have rather seen John Wayne do something a little bit more heroic, but just the same, the fact that he was gung-ho and, you know, is ready to lead the charge, I'm kind of cool with that. So I'm going to say the story is a B+. And overall, I'm going to give the book a B+.
Fair enough.
So I decided to bring today, and it was a book, I had never read it before, and I just thought, here's one, you know, that could be interesting to take a look at. And I got Captain Savage and his Leatherneck Raiders number one. So I was not familiar with this, and I've read issues of Sergeant Fury over the years, but I can't say I'm really up on all his stories. But apparently Captain Savage had appeared in several issues of Sergeant Fury and the Howling Commandos before this, so he was a known character. I think his Leatherneck Raiders are all newly introduced in this particular story, as far as I can tell. Actually, let me just check on the wiki page. Yeah, it says first appearance next to each of the Leatherneck Raiders. So this book was released on November 9th of 1967, and it has a cover date of January of 1968. The cover is by Dick Ayers, and it shows Captain Savage running, apparently on water, towards the reader with soldiers behind him, and where implored that you dare not miss this power-packed premiere issue. The story is titled The Last Banzai. It's written by Gary Friedrich, penciled by Dick Ayers, inked by Sid Shore, lettered by Artie Simic, and edited by Stan Lee. The splash page has a roll call of the characters. So there's Captain Simon Savage, and again, he's, you know, a apparently somewhat of established character at this point. But his raiders are Sergeant Yakety Yates, who's an Army man or a Marine man who resents taking orders from others. There's Colonel Jacques Larocque, a French ladies' man. There's Private J. Little Bear, a Native American professional wrestler. Private Lee Baker, a school teacher. And Seaman Blarney Stone, who's their chef. And I read this and I was a little taken aback about doing a synopsis. So I'm actually stealing the synopsis. Yes, I know we're not supposed to do that, but I'm stealing it anyway. So On November 22, 1943, 2 days after the assault on the Japanese stronghold of Tarawa began, a group of six Marines known as the Leatherneck Raiders, led by Captain Savage, banded together to attack an ammo dump at a Japanese base. As soon as they encountered some Japanese soldiers, they began to engage them in both gunfire and hand-to-hand combat. The team eventually arrived at a cave where they decided to set up camp. When they were inside, Corporal Jacques Larac pulled out photographs of a woman and stuck them to the wall, while Private Lee Baker read a book on sociology. After eating their meals, which were cooked by Seaman Blarney Stone, Captain Savage informed them that they would move out in 5 minutes to stay on schedule. The raiders moved out, and Captain Savage tripped on a bamboo pole that was left by the Japanese and was attacked by Japanese soldiers, who he defeated within minutes. Then the team came upon a mountain and began to climb it. Suddenly, Jacques lost his grip and almost fell, but hung onto a tree branch, but could not hold on for long, so Private J. Little Bear shot an arrow with a rope for Jacques to grab hold of and climb up. Once they reached the top, they came upon the Japanese base and decided to charge, firing their guns until they reached the ammo dump. When they were in range of the ammo dump, they saw a Japanese soldier threatening to blow himself up with the ammo dump unless they fell back. The raiders would not fall back, so the soldier shot himself in the head, killing him, making him drop his torch, which Little Bear shot with an arrow, stopping it from causing the ammo to combust. Captain Savage began to rig dynamite to destroy the ammo dump, but more Japanese soldiers began to storm the base as well. The raiders opened fire on the Japanese, with Little Bear gaining first blood, and fled the mountain before it could explode and cause debris to fall. The raiders got onto a raft and sailed into the Pacific Ocean until they came upon a ship with Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos. As the raiders boarded the ship, they began a friendly rivalry with the Howling Commandos. So, and then notes say that the events of this issue take place shortly after Sergeant Fury number 50. And let's see. A shocking moment occurs in this comic when a Japanese soldier commits suicide via gunshot to the head. Suicide is a very rare occurrence in comic books, and especially during the Silver Age. And that was certainly something that I thought as I read it. So the biggest problem I had with this issue is every character in it is a stereotype. And every character in it is constantly telling us what his stereotype is.
No,
I'm okay with them being stereotypes, but when you know, when you got to constantly tell you, see, and it's funny because when we did it, the first issue of G.I. Joe a while back, and I was complaining that they didn't really give us a feel for what each character was. They didn't introduce each character.
So you're saying this is what G.I. Joe needed.
I'm saying this is taking what I said and going so far the other way that I feel you need to pull back on it a little bit. I kind of enjoyed this, and I think I could get a kick out of these characters, but they have to dial it down a little bit. You know, every time, what's his name, Little Bear is saying something, he's talking about, oh, if I was wrestling, I would do this. If I was back in the States, they'd pay me to do this for wrestling. And then there's the other guy, oh, if I was teaching my students, you know, it's dial it down a little bit, dudes.
Maybe you could say, well, it is the first issue and they want you to get a feel of what these people are.
Oh, no question, that was the goal, but I think they just went a little too far with it. I think they could have given us the feel for each one a little more subtly than that. This was pretty much hitting you over the head with a brick.
Bang. I felt it was like Nick Fury and Sergeant Fury and the Commandos. Dial it up to 12 and let's see what happens.
It was, you know,
come on, isn't it very similar to the Commandos?
Oh, well, yeah, and they even, you know, they even meet each other at the end and have their little, rivalry going. But, you know, the Little Bear, I mean, what can't this guy do? He shot the arrow, the torch in the air as it fell.
It's a shame he looks like Sinestro.
So So, I mean, the Dick Ayers art is, I find his art in general to be usually pretty comfortable to read. And this, like when he draws the Japanese, they all look, you know, they don't look quite as caricaturized as like if you go to Golden Age stuff, but they're all drawn a little, just a little over the top as far as, you know, the appearances.
They're not as bad as World War II vintage, but it's a stereotype. Exactly. A strong stereotype.
Which we did not really see in the Storming Paradise issue. The American soldier who's of Japanese heritage. Mm-hmm. Like, if they weren't telling me he was Japanese, I wouldn't necessarily have seen it from the artwork.
Because it wasn't exaggerated. This is more... It's not as bad as the 40s, but it's exaggerated.
Yeah, no question. Well, I mean, in the 40s, and I know this is very politically incorrect, but I do laugh when I see the cover where it's, you know, Superman says it's okay to slap a Jap.
Yeah.
it's I mean, I guess in the 40s that was politically
It is correct. To sell bonds, though. That's why, you know.
Well, then it's okay.
Bonds to buy bombs. I looked up and it says Captain Savage's first appearance is in Sergeant Fury number 10. And I don't have it, but I'm curious to see what he looks like in number 10. I'm curious to see if he's got the beard in number 10. Because he's only referred to, it says, in number 10 as the Skipper. And it supposedly becomes Captain Savage. And that issue came out on July 9th of 1964. Now, DC had brought out previously on March 12th of 64, the first issue of Captain Storm. The PT boat skipper. So I'm curious what he looked like originally.
Well, I just did a quick Google search. I put in Sergeant Fury number 10, Captain Savage, and then I did an image search. And I see a panel, which I assume is him, and he does have the beard.
Oh, he does. Okay. So I'm wondering if they came out with this character and someone said, you got to put a beard on him or we're going to have a problem with DC. Same with ripping off their character. Because in this, he really looks like a combination of Grizzly Adams or Bluto or Brutus with that beard. Doesn't he but look
he also,
a little like...
He also has the mustache that's twirled at the ends.
Now, interesting fact, because, you know, I like to look stuff up. Typically, beards are discouraged and were discouraged in the Navy during the war, particularly because if they wanted to, you to be able to put a gas mask on, you know, if it was used. The exception was for submariners because of long voyages, they conserved water by not shaving. And Captain Savage is a submariner. So I found that interesting. Or it was just a happy coincidence that they wanted to cover up their guy from looking like Storm.
could be a little from column A and a little from column B.
And it's also not the usual that Marines are taking orders from naval officers. However, in specific situations with joint operations, Navy officers have been known to command Marines. So another good on them.
Yeah, this was, you know, apparently this group was kind of thrust upon him. So, but they are the finest troop, you know, blah, blah, blah.
I find it kind of, I don't know. I'm no general, far from it. But the idea of sending a commando unit of six in by storming a beach with guns blazing in broad daylight. I don't know. I don't think that's how it operates.
You don't think that's the best strategy?
But what do I know? Because they did take out the Japanese thing with six guys against thousands. If we dropped them into Storming Paradise, Patton wouldn't have a problem.
Yeah. That's the problem with Storming Paradise. They don't have the Leatherneck Raiders. Or the Howling Commandos.
And it's, you know, that you got to give them credit as far as the characters. You know, when you have an army comic, G.I. Joe, Sergeant Rock, with a bunch of guys in green uniforms, you kind of have to give each one a little something to make them more identifiable. This hits the ball right out of the park. You can't mix up anybody on this team.
And in its own way, this and the Howling Commandos is almost like the prototype for what eventually became the G.I. Joe comic.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, with each one with their own, you know, distinct personality and distinct skill set. So there's definitely a little something there. And again, if they weren't so beating you over the head with it, I think I would enjoy this. So I don't know if I'm ever going to get around to reading any more of this series. I think there were, I think, something like 30 issues or something like that. So it wasn't, you know, there's definitely a little bit to be read. But I wonder if that settled down as it went on and became a little bit more of a, you know, traditional late 60s, early 70s comic, you know, war comic.
See, I thought this fizzled after 18 or 19.
Is it that quick? I thought it was more.
I know they beat Captain Storm by one issue. And I think he had 18 and they had 19. Something like that. Let me check my notes.
I think you're right. I think they have 19 issues.
19, right? I think this was a matter of bad
seeing now.
Bad time. That they brought this out in, what we say, 68? And you had the Tet Offensive.
During the Vietnam War?
Tet Offensive, and then things started to change. I don't know if this came out every month or every other month. I'm thinking this was one of the casualties of the Vietnam War.
It certainly could be. So, 19 issues. Maybe at some point I may get to check out some more of it. I don't know. I can't say I'm sitting here and it's like, oh, I need to read more. Although it does promise us Baron Strucker in issue two, which would be curious.
See, now that's a draw because you'd like to see what happens with that.
Yeah.
The battle scenes, though, are very dialogue heavy. You know what I mean? For people in the middle of combat, they do a lot of pontificating.
And there's also a lot of talking or narrating what's going on with themselves in a moment where, like, you wouldn't have time to say the things they're saying, you know, like when the dude is falling from the mountain and, you know, if I grab this, I can get it before, you know. No, you don't have time to do that. You just grab it. You don't have time to narrate that you're going to grab it.
Don't you narrate everything? I'm getting up now and I'm going up the steps into the courthouse, passing through the metal detectors now.
Well, yeah, I do that, but
you also bring a soundtrack with you too.
If I could get John Williams to soundtrack my life, then it would be complete.
Good. In that case, I want to have Ted Knight voice narrate my life.
Meanwhile,
in Chambers.
So, any other thoughts?
No, I don't know. <Nah.
much. laughs> All right.
I want to see the crossover where they go up against the losers. Put my team up against your team.
Well, that's like kind of the B teams, because, you know, Sergeant Rock is your A team. Sergeant Fury is my A team.
That's the crossover now we're never going to get.
So I like this cover, and I mean, it's kind of silly, you know, like I said, it looks almost like he's running on water. But
he does have a beard too.
He does have a beard. Something about it that I find compelling. And I think if I were in the at the newsstand when this came out and I was picking out my comics for the week, pretty confident I would have bought this one. I think it's pretty well rendered, and it's promising me a power-packed premiere issue, and I think it I think the cover really does look like I'm going to get it, and I think I would have picked it up for the whopping 12 cents that it cost. The interior art is not as good, even though it's the same artist. There's things like points when the body positioning looks a little weird. Again, that, you know, the faces are a little over the top as far as the ethnicity. And the coloring is weak. It's kind of like almost like it's bled out. So, and then points where it, you know, like the grass and everything just doesn't look right. Points where the background coloring doesn't look so good. So I'm going to say art wise, I'll say a C+. It's really not doing it for me. The story is kind of fun, definitely stupid as far as the everybody declaring what their personality is in every sentence. I'm going to give it a B-. I still kind of enjoyed reading it. And overall, I'll give the book a B-.
Yeah. I am right there with you on the cover. I thought the art on the cover was great. It's dynamic. It showcases the characters. It's got even got the submarine in the background. It's a scene right out of the book. It's like a movie poster. Like, you could literally see this in the 70s style as a movie poster. So the cover got an A. The interior art, I felt it's a bit rough, but serviceable. The character designs seem to, I don't know, they seem like they reuse. It's a reuse of, like, other characters. I feel it's like ripping off Sergeant Fury and the Howling Commandos a little bit. As I said earlier, the design of Captain Savage, to me, it's throw a beard on Captain Storm, so we'll avoid a lawsuit. There's some things where I see what you mean about the body movements. For me, it was Seaman Stone at the bottom of page 3. Where he like has an exorcist turn of the head. So page 8, though, the group attack is a cool shot. And again, the stereotypical, I mean, it's a step up from the 40s, but it's still very stereotypical of the Japanese. So I gave the interior art a C. The story, you know, it's, I mean, it's fun. They don't really give you a reason why the team was put together. So, but it is the 60s, so maybe I'm asking for too much. I'm amazed at how many Japanese soldiers speak perfect English. Not talking officers. The regular guy in the trench speaks perfect English. Again, the plot's a bit of a retread of Sergeant Fury, except it seems to be aimed to appeal at fans of the Navy and the Marines. But it's, you know, it's a fun little romp. There's no deep messaging here like today.
No, not it's at all.
It's an average story. It's average. So I gave it a C. I gave it an overall grade of a C+. I am curious to see where Baron Strucker shows up, though.
Yeah, so am I. So I that might be enough to make me
continue. At least read number 2.
Yeah, and then see what I think beyond that.
And then we'll only have 17 more to go that we could spread out over the next 20 years.
We get enough projects in the works. I don't think we're going to do a Captain Savage retrospective.
I wonder if, like, they're going to jump, like, back and forth between the Pacific and the European theater, or is Strucker coming out to the Pacific?
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. But you don't even know in stories like this how much time is supposed to have passed in between issues and whatever.
I think they did that with a lot of comics too, jumping back and forth. I don't think anybody really went back and forth from the Europe to the Pacific. I think you were in one or the other. Unless that the war, sense. You know, unless Europe, you were done and they shipped you off to the Pacific.
Yeah, but that would be it. Otherwise, I wouldn't. It wouldn't make sense to utilize your resources that way.
It would make sense if you were going to publish these and keep Sergeant Fury in Europe and this guy in the Pacific.
Yeah, that makes sense. This way, you have one series focusing on each aspect. And then, you know, I'm trying to think of what other war books Marvel had. They had one called War is Hell. I think that was just an anthology series. They had, what's his name? The Deadly Dozen. I can't even think of what... Combat Kelly and the Deadly Dozen.
That was a Marvel book?
Yeah. Had nine issues, I think. We did the final issue of that series when the Deadly Dozen all meet their fate. And it was so over-the-top bad that Bill Scott and I were laughing through the whole book.
Was that a rip-off?
Through the whole episode.
Was it a rip-off of the Dirty Dozen?
Yeah.
Had to be, right? Yeah, okay.
The Deadly Dozen. So, I guess that'll do it for this particular episode. I hope you guys got a kick out of our two war books because, you know, war is hell. What can I tell you?
But Paul is a hell of a nice guy.
There you go. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.